This is Digital Story Podcast number 760, October 13th, 2020. Today's theme is 5 Things Photographers Wonder About and Sometimes Debate. I'm Derek Story. Sometimes it's nice to have someone to bounce ideas off or just ask random questions. For example, are generic camera batteries as good as the ones offered by the manufacturers at twice the price? Or what do I use if I don't like Lightroom? Well, for today, I'm here for you, and I have thoughts on these and more in today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. You know, it's funny the things that just sort of come into your mind sometimes. And yes, we have Google, and a lot of times we use Google. But the thing about Google is that you don't really have a relationship with Google in the sense there's any predictability about what Google's going to say. And the analogy that I like to use are film critics. And film critics are interesting to me because when you find a film critic that has similar taste to yours, then that film critic becomes really valuable because he or she then, you know, has opinions that more often than not, you know, you're going to like or see eye to eye with. So it's not like you just, you know, on Google, it's just like, you get all film critics, right? Just all film critics all over the map. And some of them, you know, may have the same sort of taste that you do, and some may not, and there's really no way to know. And that's kind of the cool thing when you get to hang out with someone or you have, you know, a friendship with somebody who sort of sees things the way that you do. And in photography, that can be particularly useful because as you bounce ideas off them, they're just not going to go off all over the map. You know, you go, well, what should I use? You know, Lightroom or, you know, Capture One Pro. And they go, I think you should never use anything at all. And you go, well, I have to use something. No, Finder-based is the best way to go. And you're just going, this is totally not useful. Not useful at all. I need someone that sort of understands that a photo management application is useful, you know, at least as a starting point. The reason why I bring all of this up is that with all the advantages that we have with online life these days, there are still a lot of little gaps, you know, gaps where you go, man, I just wish Google understood me. I just wish Alexa really understood me so that she would give me some sort of answer that came close to the way that I see the world. Now, that's sort of a long-winded way for me to say some of these questions that I have here, I'm sure you have asked yourself before. You know, sure that you've just kind of gone in your mind, well, you know, are they, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you kind of look it up and you get all sorts of different things. And then at some point you go, I don't know. I kind of the same spot I was before. And you still may be in the same spot that you were before with these after I talk about them. But at least we'll have fun doing it, right? And that, okay, there's something to be said for that. All right, so I have 5 things here that sort of come up, and they're fun to deal with in the world of photography. And sometimes it's really helpful to have a sounding board for these things, and I'm going to start with the first one. Are generic batteries okay to use, and are they as good as the ones sold by manufacturers at twice the price? And any of us who shoot with digital cameras, which probably is all of us, know the scenario. When you buy the digital camera, you get a battery, and it's made by the manufacturer, or at least it has the manufacturer's labeling on it. And the manufacturer is very clear about these are the only batteries that should go in your camera, because otherwise, who knows, it may just start, you know, catching on fire or go up in a poof of smoke, or the meter may suddenly give you odd readings and things like that, odd things that you just don't know. And my experience has been with third-party batteries, and generally speaking, I use Watson for my batteries that are not made by the manufacturer, and I've had great luck with them. I use them in Olympus cameras, I use them in Fuji cameras, I use them in Nikon cameras. The reason why I use them is because they cost a lot less, and my experience has been that they last as long and they perform as well. And I have yet to have a problem with any of these batteries in the sense that my camera did not perform the way that I expected it to. I have not had any of those issues at all. So right now, in the other room, I have a double charger. It's a Watson charger, double charger with removable plates. I can charge two batteries at the same time, and I can charge all sorts of different types of batteries because each little plate that costs whatever, $6 allows me to fit a specific camera battery in it. And when you're someone like me that's always having different cameras and stuff in the mix, this is really helpful. Now, when I go out for a shoot, generally speaking, I will have three batteries with me. All right, there'll be one battery in the camera, and then I'll have an extra two batteries. And rarely do I have any problems having three batteries with me, even on cameras that go through batteries pretty fast. Now, one of those three batteries will be the manufacturer's battery, and the other two, generally speaking, are made by someone else, like Watson or something like that. And I don't even think about which battery is in the camera at any given. It's not like I say, I'm always going to start with the manufacturer's battery, and then if I have to, I'll go to the Watson. I don't do that. I mean, sometimes the Watson starts out in there, sometimes the manufacturer. It doesn't make any difference, and I don't notice any difference. So, to answer this particular question, I don't know what Google says, but what I say is it's okay to use generic batteries. Look at the reviews before you buy it. Photographers will tell you if this battery is performing well or not. If it's got 4-star rating or more, and most of the comments are, hey, this thing, I can't even tell the difference, it's probably safe for you to use it, and you will save a boatload of money. In other words, you could buy two of those batteries and probably a portable charger for the price that the manufacturer wants to charge you for their battery. I've had good luck with them. You have to take any advice from some guy like me online with a grain of salt. I'm only relating my experience, but my experience has been quite good with generic batteries. All right, let's do another one of these. Should I use a protection filter or not on my lens? Oh, people love to talk about this one. They do, don't they? And, you know, we've had little dust-ups with this ourselves in our community, little friendly chats, shall I say. And I'm of the school, I like protection filters. Not so much because I believe they protect my lens. I know they don't, because if a rock is hurling at the front of your lens, you have a protection filter on there, it will go through the protection filter and then probably keep going right onto your lens. So in that sense, they're not really protection filters, and that's not really why I put them on there. I try to avoid having my lens in the line of a hurling rock. Okay, that's just, you know, one of my little rules for photography. However, I do like a clean front lens, and I am an outdoor kind of guy. I'm in all sorts of different situations. Stuff happens in the world. And the thing I like about having a high-quality, multi-coated filter on my very expensive lenses is that if some schmutz gets on there, then I can just, like, with my lens, take my T-shirt, find a microfiber cloth, whatever, and just wipe it off and not really think about it. I don't have to worry about being real finicky when I clean the front of the lens, because I'm not cleaning the front of the lens, I'm cleaning the protection filter itself. Now, in terms of quality, image quality, if you get a good filter, one that has multi-coatings and basically is the same kind of glass as the glass that's in your lens, I don't notice a difference in quality. I honestly don't. Now, if you put something, you know, that you find in the sock drawer from 1957 on the front, you might notice a difference, right? Especially if it doesn't have any coatings at all. Sure, because the light transmission isn't going to be as good. What multicoatings do is they make that light transmission on par with the light transmission that your lens has, okay? But if you have a good quality filter on there, it just makes life so much easier. You just don't have to think about what's going on out there. A little bit of rain happens and splatters get on the front, no problem, right? I mean, I usually have a lens hood on there as well, but I can just wipe it off really quickly and then keep shooting. Don't have to baby it. When I get home, if I want, and then I can, you know, give the filter a nice cleaning with all the good stuff, you know, the nice cloth and all that sort of stuff. But for me, protection filters just mean that I can keep the front of my lens clean on the fly and I don't have to baby the lens. I like that. So I say yes to protection filters. They are a good thing and I haven't noticed any problems with image quality at all, maybe because I use good filters. Here's a good one for nimble photographers. Do I really need a tripod? Well, I mean, if you shoot with an Olympus EM1 Mark III, the answer is probably no, in all honesty. Okay, let's back up for a minute. What are tripods used for? And, you know, what did they used to be used for? And what is their role today? Because those are kind of different things. For instance, when I shoot film, and I have ISO 200 film in the camera, I can't jack up that ISO to 1600, 3200, 6400, whatever. It's 200 no matter what. And so there are situations when I want to have just a little bit of depth of field. Let's say stop down to f5.6 or maybe even 8. That shutter speed gets really slow. So I do need to find a way to steady the camera. When I'm shooting with my Olympus cameras, my Pentax, any of those cameras that have image stabilization, I don't even think about that at all. My auto ISOs now go up to 6400, and I never have to worry about a slow shutter speed unless I'm really in some kind of dark situation. That old use for tripods has really kind of gone away. Now, there are two situations these days when I do use a tripod, and almost always it's for one of those two situations, which is night sky photography. Night sky photography is the time that I do like to have a tripod. Now, even with the EM1 Mark III that has the, you know, the star capture function, you can handhold the camera and capture stars. But using a tripod really helps me kind of line things up and, you know, look at what's going on. And, you know, that slower, more methodical approach really works for me. And I just got a good taste of that when, you know, I was out working, taking pictures of Comet Neowise. So that is one situation where I do like a tripod for night sky photography. The other is occasionally for landscape photography, where I really want some serious depth of field and I want to use a lower ISO. Tripods come in handy for that. Again, I probably could achieve the same results in terms of aperture and shutter speed handheld thanks to image stabilization. But there's something about landscape photography, again, where I sort of like to look at the scene and think about it and study it and really kind of get into it. And a tripod actually helps me do that. Oh, and I just thought of the third time that I do use a tripod, which is for video work. I still like having a tripod for certain types of video work. I think it comes in really super handy. So there are times when I need a tripod, but if I'm going out on a hike and I know I want to do some nature photography, I know I want to do some nice landscape stuff and all that, most of the time, to be honest with you, I don't take a tripod. Image stabilization is so good. I can generally get the aperture that I, you know, that I want handheld. And I really enjoy not having to carry a tripod. So my answer to that is that I think tripods are still useful tools to have. I just don't need them as much as I used to. Now I have, it looks like, three specific situations where they come in handy. And then the rest of the time, where I used to need a tripod, I can handhold the camera. And thank you, Olympus, Pentax, everyone that has put internal image stabilization in the camera. Thank you so much for saving me from having to carry the three-legged beast all the time. All right, number four. Here's the fourth one. Do I need a full-frame camera to be a professional photographer? I mean, oh my word, really now. And I think this audience is probably a little different than a lot of other audiences in terms of this question, because I think this audience understands that it's not the size of the sensor, but it's the skill of the photographer that really matters here. However, that being said, let's talk about full-frame cameras, because they are coming at us, you know, hot and fast these days. I shoot full-frame all the time when I shoot film, right? And of course, I have a couple of full-frame Nikons that I use every now and then as well. And there are a couple times when I do like full frame. One of them is when I'm shooting portrait work. Full frame is nice with certain lenses. It's really fun. That being said, I will pull out, in my case, the EM1 Mark II. I will put the Olympus 75mm f1.8 on there, and I will have great results. Or I put the 45mm f1.2 on there and have great results. So even the times that I sometimes like to use full frame, I don't really even need it then. And I don't always then. It's funny, this is a little bit of a sidetrack here, but I was judging a photo competition last week, and I don't get to see any of the metadata originally when I'm judging the shots. And then, you know, I pick the winners, all that. And then when we're having the discussion about the shots and all that, then they reveal the metadata. I get to see it then. So I didn't know what cameras are used for what. And the shot that I picked for the grand prize winner was this really cool. It was a sand wasp in flight carrying a fly that it had killed back, you know, to the larva. And it was in mid-flight, and then there was some pretty plants and so forth around it that were nice and soft. And this shot was absolutely wonderful. I loved this shot. One of the things I liked about the shot was that the wasp itself was perfectly sharp, all of the wasp. There wasn't any trail off or any of that sort of stuff. And the fly that it had captured was sharp as well. But yet, when you got beyond the wasp, things got really beautiful and creamy and all of that kind of stuff. Well, I learned afterwards, it was captured with a EM1 Mark III and one of the long lenses. I forget which one he was using, either the 100 to 400 or the 300. I forget exactly, but one of the long Olympus lenses. And the thing that I've noticed about shooting with Micro Four Thirds is that you still get the fall off behind the subject on portraits, or in this case, wasps. But the subject itself, you have more room to play in terms of depth of field. And I've noticed this on shallow depth of field portraits too, is that both eyes will be sharp and then it'll start to fall off, you know, around the ears and the hair and everything. Whereas with a full frame and a long lens, you may get one eye sharp and then the other eye will be too soft. And so there are times, even when you like soft backgrounds and all that kind of stuff, where Micro Four Thirds just makes more sense, because your subject itself, the odds of it being sharp are higher and you still get the lovely background. So I've just undercut, you know, even the one time I could really think that I need a full frame camera. The other one, of course, would be with certain full frame cameras, you can put the ISO up much higher than you can maybe with a Micro Four Thirds. Those are situations that I don't need or take advantage of. I appreciate them, but it's not an everyday thing for me. So then beyond that, I start running out of reasons. Now, I am a professional photographer. I do this for a living, I have been for a long time. And I show up on photo shoots all the time with cropped frame sensors, either APS-C or Micro Four Thirds. And sometimes I show up with a full frame if I feel like there's a reason why I need it or a specific lens. So the answer is, do you need a full frame camera to be a professional photographer? No, you do not. You absolutely do not. And in fact, I think there are many, many scenarios where having the cropped frame sensor is actually better than the full frame sensor. They are easier to manage. The depth of field is easier to manage with a cropped frame sensor, in my opinion, than the full framers. I'll give you one more example, then I'll let go of this. All right. So I do a lot of product photography for the film camera shop and, you know, all the stuff that I do. I go back and forth between two cameras. I have two cameras that I like. One is the EM5 Mark II with the Leica 25mm f1.4 on there. Love that combo. Really wonderful. And then the other one that I use is a Nikon D700 with the Voigtlander 40mm f2 on there. And I love that combination too. But I should say to you that I can shoot at f4 with the Olympus and generally have everything in focus that I want. And with the Nikon full frame, I have to go to f8, generally speaking, to get everything that I want in focus. You know, and so this is for product photography. And I'm shooting relatively close. You know, I'm shooting cameras and lenses and stuff like that. So that is another scenario where I really notice the difference in terms of depth of field with the full frame versus the Micro Four Thirds. The Micro Four Thirds just makes my life easier in those situations because I get more depth of field naturally. So I don't want to crank the lights all the way up or whatever. I don't have to, and I can get by at f4 with the Micro Four Thirds. No. Don't need it. Don't need full frame. They're lovely cameras. I think they're kind of cool, but you don't need it to be a pro. All right, last one here. What do I do if I don't like Lightroom? I know. I mean, it just seems like Lightroom everywhere, right? Right? Everything's Lightroom, 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 Lightroom. If you don't like Lightroom, and some photographers just don't, it just doesn't sing to them. And, you know, we all know Lightroom is a wonderful application. It's evolved beautifully, all that stuff. But some folks just don't like it. And if you don't like Lightroom, I will tell you, if you want a photo management application, then I would look at either Capture One Pro, or I would give, if you're on a Mac, a second look at Photos. And again, a lot of people, you know, whenever I say Photos, they go, ah, you know, Photos stinks. You know, I want Aperture again. Well, I mean, that was a long time ago. A lot of things have changed, including the editing extensions for Photos. However, if you have really looked at everything that Photos can do, including the editing extensions, it's still not quite enough for you, then I definitely would say Capture One Pro is a beautiful application. And I think that most people will be happy either with Lightroom or Capture One Pro. I think those two apps will cover 90% of the photographers out there. If you don't like Lightroom, then I would say look at Capture One Pro. Try, you know, download it. You can do 30 days free, all that sort of stuff. And keep in mind that whenever you learn a new application, especially a photo management application, movie editing application, all that, there is a curve there. It's going to take you a while to get comfortable, especially if you've just kind of been on autopilot with whatever you've been using to that point. So keep in mind that there's a learning curve and factor that in to your decision. But if you don't like Lightroom, there are a couple good alternatives. Capture One Pro at the top of the list. All right, so those are the five things, there are many more, we may do this again. There are five things that most of us have wondered about and even sometimes debate. If you would like to agree or debate any of the stances I take on these five things, stop by the Facebook page and let me know what you think. All right, this second piece kind of piggybacks on last week's second piece, which was a note from Panasonic that they didn't anticipate Olympus photographers moving over to Panasonic now that Olympus has jettisoned the camera division to JIP. I got a lot of emails, text messages. I got all sorts of stuff from you. No one posted on Facebook, but everyone contacted me in other ways. Every one of you who contacted me said that, no, I'm not switching to Panasonic. I'm going to use my Olympus cameras, and I'm going to hope that JIP continues to produce Olympus cameras, because Panasonic cameras and Olympus cameras are not the same. So I thought that was really interesting. It was solid. There was no gray area on this particular topic. So then this week I found this piece here that I'm going to read to you right now. And I think it sort of piggybacks on that earlier discussion we had. It's on the Phoblographer, and there's a link to the full review. A big misstep for Micro Four Thirds, the Panasonic G100 review. All right. And let me just read you this, because I think it kind of ties into what we were talking about last week. The Panasonic G100 has a good but not great build qualities. For a camera that costs $747, I was expecting a little more. The G100 does not feel as nice as the Olympus EM10 Mark IV. It falls quite short of the Fujifilm X-T200 and is behind the Sony A6100 and Nikon Z50, all of which have similar price points. The plastic body feels just okay. The texture on the grip feels pretty cheap. All the dials are plastic, and a few of the buttons feel mushy when pressed. The on-off switch honestly feels like it might break. I'm sure the camera will stand up to a few bumps and bangs, but it didn't exactly install a lot of confidence in me. Again, this is a review on the Phoblographer. Not surprisingly, the G100 does not have weather sealing. No weather sealing means you cannot take the camera out into the snow or rain. Okay. And then they go on, I think Panasonic had good intentions with the G100, but they missed the mark. The camera will appeal to vloggers because of its small size and weight. The fully articulating screen is nice too, and that's great for both stills and video. The sensor can produce excellent images, and a lot can be done with the RAW files. The colors are pleasant, and you'll find there's plenty of dynamic range, but there are too many shortcomings. It appears Panasonic thought that the higher resolution electronic viewfinder and LCD would be better than IBIS, built-in image stabilization. To keep the cost down, they could have had either one, but not both. They made the wrong choice. I love the EVF and the LCD, but removing image stabilization was a mistake. And finally, the Panasonic Lumix G100 is capable of producing splendid images, but autofocus performance, lack of IBIS, and mediocre battery life really harmed this camera. At $747 with the kit lens, it's priced a little high in this price bracket. There are better options out there that perform better in almost every area for hybrid shooters. You know, I didn't pick this post for the second segment today because I want to pick on Panasonic, because I don't really. I like Panasonic a lot. And as I mentioned last week, I like a lot of their lenses. However, this review does seem to capture the spirit of what a lot of you relayed to me privately when I asked you if you would consider Panasonic cameras in lieu of Olympus cameras while we wait to see what happens with JIP. All of you said no. And then this review for the G100 comes out, which sort of reinforces why you said no. Panasonic themselves said, as you may recall last week, they are thinking that they're more video specialists with Micro Four Thirds and Olympus more stills photography specialists. I think the G100 sort of plays into that thinking as well. I thought you might enjoy the follow-up, and I'm sorry, Panasonic. I promise I won't have a story on you next week. I have a new ebook available in all sorts of places. How to Get Started with Film Photography. Let me just tell you about this. It's fresh off the press, This 57-page ebook in universal PDF format provides an excellent introduction to film photography, along with an abundance of illustrations, and I'm not kidding there. You'll learn how to, and let me give you some bullet points here. Find the right camera for you, because, you know, that can be daunting if you haven't looked at film cameras for a while. Choose the best film for your kind of photography. Discover the lenses that you should add to your kit. So the one that you should start with, and then what should you add up the road? The ins and outs of film processing. How to develop black and white film at home. And that's without a darkroom. That's like right there in your kitchen. Master basic shooting techniques, and then see how to care for your gear with some nice tips on how to do that. So this ebook is $5.99. How to Get Started with Film Photography. You can get it on the Nimble Photographer if you go to our workshops page, where we have the Eastern Sierra online workshop, where we have the video online video courses for digitizing family memories and how to video conference like a pro. That ebook is there now with all of those goodies. So you have another goodie in the goodie basket. Or if you go to the Film Camera Shop on Etsy, you can get it there as well. Either place, it's $5.99. It looks great on the iPad, by the way. I designed it so that it would look good on smartphones and tablets. But it also looks very good on the computer as well. PDF, you can view it anywhere. If you're curious about how to get started with film photography, this will get you headed in the right direction. I think you'll like it. Lots of pictures, lots of goodies. I hope you enjoy it. All right, let's do a little virtual camera club business. And I'd like to start off with our Inner Circle members. We have some new members this week. Welcome, new Inner Circle members, and thank you so much for being a part of this group of artists who help support this podcast, the workshop series, the online courses, all that good stuff. You help with all of that stuff, and I thank you so much. If you are interested in becoming an Inner Circle member and getting the goodies that come with membership, such as, for example, on the new online workshop, Inner Circle members get $25 off. So it's only $125 for them, and it's $150 for everyone else. That's just one of many, many, many things. Lots of freebies too. When I mentioned the online video conferencing course or digitizing family memories, they got those for free. They didn't have to pay anything. Inner Circle members got that for free. It's my way of saying thank you for your continued support. Having that monthly support really helps me plan what I'm going to do 2 months from now, 5 months from now, a year from now. And that's why it's so important. So thank you so much. You can become a member of the Inner Circle by just clicking on the Patreon tile that's on every page of the Digital Story. Click on there, go over there, take a look, join us, become part of the Inner Circle, and start enjoying the camaraderie and the benefits of doing so. I have B&H and Amazon tiles on the Digital Story, every page of the Digital Story. If you're going to do a little shopping, if you would go to the Digital Story first and click on one of those tiles, they're in the second column. That'll take you over to their sites, those respective sites. And then you can just navigate, you know, however you want. And by doing so, you help support this site and it doesn't cost you a penny more. Also, the links that I put in the show notes and the articles are also affiliate links. And if you click on those, if you're going to make a purchase, then that also helps us show. Thank you so much for taking that extra step. Those add up. Those add up. And finally, a huge thanks to our friends at Red River Paper. They are the paper gurus, the inkjet specialists, the printing masters of our universe, and they're really nice guys and gals too. This is the time of year when you want to be thinking about maybe getting a little ahead of the curve in the printing world so that you have those fine art cards ready, so that you have some prints ready. So when it's time to give a gift, you can give the most personal gift that an artist could give to somebody, which is something that you envisioned, something you captured, something that you edited and nurtured, and something that you printed. Oh my word, how lovely is that? And you can find out about all of that and get just the right paper for you, ink and everything else, at Red River Paper. Just click on the tiles on all the pages of the digital story, or go to their Facebook page at facebook.com/Red River Paper. Thank you so much for sponsoring this podcast. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. If you want to take me to task on any of those things, just go to our Facebook page and let me know what you think. Come back and join me next week. I'm working on some more goodies. Until then, stay safe, be creative, and have a great week. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.